I want to start the informational meeting of the House Education Subcommittee on Education Innovation. And I'm laughing because it's like, you know, if you say it 5,000 times, what that would turn out to be, I don't know what it would be. I am State Representative Betty Comp. I have the privilege and the honor to chair this committee for the 74th legislative session. And I am from House District 22, which is Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and a slice of North Salem. It's right in the middle. It's not east and it's not west. It's just right in the middle. And my constituents are just, you know, when you need to get some work done. And with that, I want to introduce the other members of the committee. We have, as our wonderful vice chair, Representative Minnis. Our other vice chair is Representative Roblin. And on my left again is Representative Peter Buckley. And on next to him is one of our freshman young people that are so good, Representative Ben Cannon. And on my right are my wonderful friends and colleagues, Representative Dahlem, John Dahlem, and Representative Jean Wisnett. If the members of the committee would please just say a little bit about yourself, and if you have a wish for this committee or something that you'd really like to see us accomplish, please add that into it if you'd like. And with that, Representative Minnis.
Well, I think I know everybody here, but it's an honor to be here and participate with the committee, and looking forward to being helpful and working with you. So let's get to work, roll up our sleeves, and do our job.
Representative Roblin?
Yeah, I too am really pleased to be here. This is a great group of people to work with. I look forward to that. I think we have a lot of things to do this year, and I'm really pleased that we're starting out with the Quality Education Commission and the model and some information about it, because I think that should be a part of, as we look at education, all the effort that was put into that is a good guideline for us as we move forward this session.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very glad we were able to set up the committee structure this way. There seems to be a lot of momentum for innovation this year with the different proposals coming from all sides, but the different proposals all seem to be moving into a large stream, and I'm excited to swim in it with all you guys. So.
I don't know how to swim. You're going to have to be the teacher.
We'll sail.
We'll sail. Representative Cannon?
I'm Representative Ben Cannon, representing District 46, which is in Portland. I don't know all of you, so I will offer that. I am a teacher, and so I'm on leave of absence for this committee. Excited to be here. And I love the name of the committee, Education Innovation. I hope that we are considering some ways to innovate in education. And I also am excited to be beginning with this wonderful model and learning more about it. I'm also, as a freshman member, I'm really impressed by, so far, by the degree to which these committees and this committee structure exist to help us deliberate thoughtfully around issues. And it's a slow process, but it's a deliberative one, and there's a reason for that. I went home and told my wife this weekend, the gears of democracy move turn very slowly, because we haven't done a whole lot yet. Now we have a snow day, but there's a reason for that, and I look forward to working with this talented group on ideas for education.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem?
This is the second session for me, and the committee structure is different. I look forward to seeing how this structure will work as opposed to the last one. I think education is probably the single largest issue our state faces, and to be involved in education is to be involved deeply in the business of the state, and I look forward to it.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to serve on this committee. In the two and two-thirds terms I've been in the building, I've worked on education issues on this committee during the interim, and ways and means education, and look forward to working with the members and the chairman. Chair, ladies.
I will. You can call me anything you want, just so long as you do it with respect. So I've been called lots of things, but with lots of respect. We have we as a committee don't survive without the people that work with us and provide us all the information, help us gather all of you into the room. And so it is really my honor to introduce our committee administrator. And for the sub, this is Rick Percobian. And he is here with his expertise of working, I don't know how many years in the Senate.
Senate and House, both since the 2001 session.
Okay. He has a wealth of experience, so he is my teacher and my guide. And my other administrator that's helping us right now as we're transitioning is the committee administrator for the full committee. And Derek is back here if you want to stand. This is Derek Olson. He's helping us get organized and getting the agendas together and teaching us all the things about how to be a good committee. And then our wonderful city committee assistant, Andy Woodrum. And she's going to keep me all legit here with, you know, making sure our motions are right and we do all the correct rules. So appreciate your help. We literally can't do the job without you. To move on, if you're not on the full committee, there's a couple of people here that aren't on the full committee. If you had any questions about the rules that were adopted by the full committee, please, if you have any concerns or questions, I'd post those now. No? Okay. Okay, thank you. Reminders to the committee and members of the public. Rules adopted by the full committee apply to the subcommittee. They offer a review for any members who may not have been present at the full committee last week. Type meetings, we have a type meeting schedule. I do like to begin on time and end on time. My background of being a teacher and a principal, I know how when the bell rings, we need to be ready for giving the lesson and being respectful for the people that follow us. So we will do that. We will meet on Tuesdays, Thursdays in this hearing room until probably the end of May or whenever our committee bills are heard. Full committee meetings meet on Fridays, and that's at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room F. Our Higher Education Subcommittee, chaired by Representative Buckley, meets again at 1 o'clock on Mondays and Wednesdays. And obviously, these two committees are going to work very much hand in hand. Please, if you have cell phones, make sure they're off, not just silenced, because our system does pick up the vibrating sounds from BlackBerries in particular, and it does interrupt the testimony of people at times that are presenting. Our microphones, I think we have a new system. We were told very distinctly that they're more sensitive than ever, so if you whisper, you might turn to the side a little bit, otherwise everything you say is recorded. And also we have a new media exchange for our committee is on the Oregon Channel and is being broadcast on TV and via internet. Any questions or concerns, Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you please tell me if the committee plans or the chair of the full committee plans to have hearings on the bills that were the interim committee bills? I drafted some of those. If not, I'd like to bring them up or work them as individual bill.
Okay. Well, I'm going to refer this question to Representative Buckley because we did talk about some of this just this morning. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Go with his leadership.
Representative, we were reviewing the bills from the interim committee, and I should be able to get an answer to you on specific bills by early next week.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments about process? Well, thank you. Appreciate it. This is my first adventure at chairing the committee, so I appreciate your patience. But at this time, because we have two pretty hefty topics to go over today, and we want to get started. And so at this time, because we've already opened the informational hearing, I invite the witnesses to the table for the quality education model, and that's Pat Burke and Susan Massey. And I believe, Pat, you're going to start?
I think Susan. I'm sure it's going to make some opening remarks.
Hi, I'm Susan Massey from Coos Bay, and I am chairing the Quality Education Committee, and I feel very honored to be doing so. This was groundbreaking work when it began, and I think it continues to be very exciting. I just wanted to highlight briefly the three things that we have taken on as sort of major agenda items for this cycle. One is some trending data showing historic spending for education over the past several years. We also did a study of the relationship between funding and student performance, and we are concerned that we communicate better. We have good data, good information at our disposal, and we want to be more effective at sharing that. I just want to invite this committee and anyone in the legislature who would be interested to use the commission to the extent possible, because we believe that we can help provide good information. And we're really pleased to be staffed by Pat Burke and Brian Reeder, who's here today, and I'll turn the rest of the time over to them.
Thank you, Susan. Pat, do you want to make sure we do your name for the record?
Correct, Madam Chair. I'm Pat Burke, B-U-R-K. I'm the Chief Policy Officer at the Oregon Department of Education. It's a pleasure to be back before this committee. I had an opportunity during the interim to work with the interim committee. Madam Chair, I'd like to particularly express my gratitude that the committee is interested in looking at the QEM as a first step in your work. Many of you in your introductory remarks used terms like framework, a way of thinking, an analytic tool, and that is exactly what the model is designed to be. So we are very pleased to be here, and thank you for your interest. I'm going to provide an overview of both the model and the commission. I'm not going to go into a lot of the detail about the numbers. We have provided you linkages to the report and some of the background research. It would take literally hours to work through all of that. So what I'd like to do is review with you some of the history and the creation of the model, what the model actually is, and some of the current findings. As you know, Oregon set some very high educational goals in statute, including having the best educated citizens in the world. That's a pretty lofty goal for Oregon to set. And we can argue the details, but I think the important thing here is that the Oregon legislature and the Oregon public have very high expectations for their schools. Now, so within that framework, what is the quality education model? Sorry.
Hello. We're rolling.
The model emerged in the House of Representatives in 1997-98 and took the form of the Legislative Council on the Quality Education Model under the leadership of then-Speaker Len Lundquist. A set of statewide dialogues for about a year and a half began with legislators, educators, members of the public, school superintendents, teachers, principals, very large group. And out of that became the identification of 23 research-based factors that contribute to increasing student achievement in schools, and the target was set at 90%. And there have been a lot of questions about, well, why 90%? And the thinking of the committee at the time was that final 10% of students who are not at standard represents a very difficult group of students to reach. They are some of our, for example, most disabled students or students who do not have English as a primary language. And the thinking at the time, remember this was 1998-99, that we would have to consider something different for that final 10%. And indeed, as you know, the legislature in subsequent sessions did approve approve the high-cost special education funding addition to the formula, which was a way of addressing that 10%. There was also an innovation that took place at the time that I think still remains today a remarkable tool, which is the development of what is known as the database initiative data. And what that represents is a common chart of accounts that did not exist prior to the DBI, where financial data from school districts are reported against a common set of definitions. So that gave us, for the first time, the ability to look across the 198 school districts to see what they were spending on specific items, such as teacher salary, for example. The data then, those data, the DBI data, once the commission was established, and I'll talk a little bit about the commission in a moment, the data are updated on a biennial basis by the commission. So in meeting its statutory requirement, the commission, one of the things it has to do is repopulate the model with the most recent data that we have, and that's one of the first tasks that the commission does. Then there is a per-student cost calculated in the model based upon three prototypical schools. And I want to be very clear that they are prototypes for planning purposes. They are not intended as model schools or definitive schools. They are prototypes to identify factors that we can then gather information from around the state on what is spent on those factors and build that into a model for planning and analysis purposes. That's always been the purpose, and unfortunately, I think sometimes the model gets presented as you either do it this way or you're not being fair to kids or you're not providing good schools. It's not really the intent. The intent is an analytical tool for your use and for the legislator's use. Those costs then, when you work that through a formula in the three prototypes, that would generate an individual student number, which is then applied to the state population, school population. The model assumes that schools that had these characteristics would reflect 12 quality indicators that the commission identified, that the schools themselves would have strong leadership, that there would be strong parental and community involvement, that they would be adaptable to the needs of the unique needs of their communities and kids, that there would be a safe and orderly environment, and that there would be district policies in place that support student learning. Teachers would reflect high quality and have high degrees of professional preparation and be effective classroom instructors. Classrooms would follow effective instructional methods. There would be regular collection of data on student performance to inform instruction, that students at different stages along the way would demonstrate readiness to learn, and that the school would have a sense of connectedness to the academic and extracurricular activities. So what were the components of the model? As I mentioned, there are three prototypical schools based on 90%. So there's an elementary prototype, a middle school prototype, and a high school prototype. And they are based on assumptions. It's very important to understand what the assumptions are, and those assumptions are explained in detail in the report that you have. So there are assumptions about demographics of the prototypical school, about the availability of technology, assumptions about staff quality, assumptions about school size, and opportunity for ongoing professional growth. You're going to hear me keep saying that word assumption several times. It's really important to understand the assumptions in the model to really make good use of it. The model also assumes that each prototype has an adequate level of staffing, that there's added instructional time for students in need, either extended day or extended year programs. It assumes that there would be curriculum development and technology support, both at the district level and at the school level, that there would be on-site instructional improvement, professional development for teachers, an adequate classroom supply and textbook fund, and adequate funds for maintenance. And again, all of that gets built into a model. There are 23 factors. And then we use the database initiative data to pull in, so what do Oregon schools spend now on those factors? And that gets populated into the model. And then that is used to calculate a per pupil cost at the elementary, middle, and high school level. prototypes at the elementary level assumes 340. Again, understanding the assumption. It's not presented as a model of all Oregon schools should look like this. It's just understanding the assumptions. It assumes all-day kindergarten. It assumes a class size of 20 at the primary grades before grade 2. It assumes, before grade 3, and then assumes a class size of 24 in grades 4 and 5, and 4.5 FTE for specialists. Now, I'll stop here, and just as an example on how you could use the tool, if you said, so what if we wanted to raise the 4th and 5th grade class size to 26? What would that do to our cost? The model lets you make those assumptions, plug those numbers in, and see what that would generate. The middle school model assumes 500 students with an average class size of 25. It also assumes some additional alternative programs for students at risk. And this particular number, the one counselor for every 250 students, is something that we have heard frequently from the field is very desirable, but many of our middle schools do not currently have this number. That gives you another example of how the model could be useful. At the high school level, the model assumes 1,000 students with an average class size of 24, with additional support in English, mathematics, and science. And then there are a number of things that all three of the prototypes assume. Some form of extended day or extended year, particularly for students in need, either after school or summer school types of programs. Specialized staff in library, PE, music, special education services, and English as a second language. This is particularly important when you look at the impact of the model. I can show you some numbers. You may have also seen it in the model. That the appearance of elementary librarians, for example, is on the decline, whereas the increase in educational assistance is on the increase when you look at staffing across the state. Professional development for staff is an assumption. An adequate number of computers per student is in the model. That's certainly debatable. At the elementary level, for example, it's a 1-to-6 ratio. There are many of us, maybe tilting a little bias there, but there are many people that are advocating for a 1-to-1 ratio, that every student should have access to a laptop computer. So the model assumes a 1-to-6 ratio at the elementary level. An adequate number of supplies. And then at the central office level, a certain level of funding for operations and maintenance, student transportation, centralized special education support, technology, and district administrator support. For example, business services, payroll, human resources, and so on. So all of that gets run through the model. And the model then generates a comparison between the essential budget level. This is the current essential budget level, numbers that I think you are well aware of. We're talking right now about an essential budget level of about $5.8 billion. And then it compares that to what full funding of the model would generate. And then it subtracts or calculates the difference between what the model would suggest and what current EBL would be, and generates the gap figure. Now, the legislature put into statute the requirement that the commission produce the gap number. That is a charge. So we produce the gap number. And as you can see, the gap number for this year is about $1.96 billion. Now, I'm very cautious about this because what we have seen in the past, and Chair Massey may want to address this later, sometimes people see that number and all conversation stops. They say, well, you're talking about almost $2 billion above the central budget level. That's so far out of reach, the dialogue stops. What we would prefer is that the model itself and the data in the model be seen by you and others as an analytical tool. That if we wanted something different from essential budget level, or we wanted to think differently about different components, we have a tool to do that, and not to get hung up on just talking about whether or not 1.96 is achievable or not. Now, let me turn quickly to the commission itself. The commission was established by executive order under Governor Kitzhaber and State Superintendent Stan Bunn on November 5th, 1999. The commission was charged with, if you will, the care and maintenance of the model, to meet on a biennial or to report on a biennial basis on the model. Ballot measure one was approved by the voters in November of 2000, and part of that ballot measure said that the amount of money needed to meet the QEM goals would be appropriated, or the legislature would issue a report on the reasons for the deficiency. This is known as the Ballot Measure 1 report. It comes out every 2 years. Then the charge to the commission was modified by the legislature and was actually put into statute in 2001 under revised statute 327-500 and 506. The commission is comprised of 11 members. The members are appointed by the governor, and the governor's appointments try to reflect a regional distribution around the state. And the commission is charged with issuing a report on a biennial basis to you and to the governor. These are the current members of the commission. You have a brochure that lists them on the back. As you can see, it reflects a cross-section of business and education leadership and is distributed across across the state. The charge to the commission is to determine the amount of money needed to fully fund the system and to identify best practices in education. It's to issue a report that looks at current K-12 practices, the cost of continuing those practices, the expected outcomes of those practices, what practices would be needed to meet the goals of the state, the costs, and the expected student performance. And then what was added when the commission was moved into statute was that the commission is also charged with creating two alternatives to the model on a biennial basis for your consideration. So, as I've been saying, the role of the commission is to help policymakers understand how the money impacts student achievement, to identify key policy issues and to enhance our understanding of the system and to estimate the funding requirements. It is not, and I will say it again, it is not to advocate for that single number. It is to inform policy discussion. The commission tends to look at three main focuses: accountability and governance structures, the efficiency of our utilization of the state school fund, and the adequacy of those funds. The commission this year, under Susan's leadership, established three key goals: to provide timely and relevant data useful to the legislature and the public. Now, I want to point out that we received some excellent guidance from Senator Frank Morse, who attended the first meeting of the commission in this cycle, who urged on behalf of the legislature that the commission's work be made more transparent and more useful and more easily understood. And the commission listened to that recommendation and adopted it as its first goal for this year. Secondly, we wanted to go deeper in understanding the relationship between funding and student performance, and that we set out to sponsor research to do that. And finally, to provide effective, clear, and helpful communication. What was new in this session and what you will see in the report are two elements that we had never done before. One was we contracted with Echo Northwest to do an in-depth production function analysis and with an outside consultant. Dr. Duncombe is identified in the report. We asked Dr. Duncombe and Echo Northwest to help us look at production function, that is, what is the relationship between expenditure and outcome, and a more detailed analysis of state spending on both objects and functions in our cost. I won't review all the data. You have a copy of it. It's pretty detailed and a little heavy going. But just at a high level, in the production function analysis, what we found, what the research indicated, is that there was statistically significant connection between increased spending on instruction and student performance, even when controlling for the effects of other variables such as limited English proficiency, poverty, and special ed. That's an important finding. In other words, the money matters. However, what the analysis also indicated is that money is not sufficient. It's not just about spending more money. It's also about what you spend the money on and identifying effective instructional programs and having the capacity to do that type of analysis and to inform those decisions and target your funding wisely. The spending analysis also identified a couple of key findings. One is that growth in per pupil spending in Oregon began to decline in about 2001. It had been, prior to 2001, increasing. Oregon's K-12 spending as a percentage of personal income dropped below the national average, also beginning in 2001. Oregon's salary, there's always a lot of questions about this, looking at both salary and total compensation. Oregon salaries rank 18th in the United States and 12th in the nation in total compensation. And the difference there has to do with insurance costs and purse costs in Oregon if you look at the national models. Oregon's per student spending is now about $566 below the national average. And Oregon spends more than average on student transportation and less on non-instructional areas such as maintenance and capital expenditure. Again, there's a lot more detail available to you in the Echo Northwest report, which you have a copy of.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Speaking on the model and the assumptions, one of the things Echo Northwest discussed with the Interim Committee on Education was a little more ability to see the whole picture, particularly this is a ways and means question. And we tend to fund in our education system in silos, higher ed, K-12. We don't really talk about what the local level is putting in, what the local components are. Did you guys discuss that? Because they said that, in their opinion, it's a mistake because the committee doesn't have an ability to see across the spectrum what the full amount is being allocated between local and state, what the real dollars, federal dollars, what the total amount is.
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, it's an excellent question, and yes, the committee did spend a lot of time on it. I did not provide all of the graphics or charts. We can get lost in that information, but if I can go back here, one of the things where we did specifically try to address your question is to begin to identify and take back out of the formula things like federal funding that goes to school districts. You notice that has been removed from the funding, and revenue not found in the formula, plus local property taxes and other resources. You're absolutely correct. And Echo Northwest did make a recommendation to look at the total investment, not just state dollars. So mm-hmm. many districts, for example, have local options where additional local money has been contributed. You have timber revenue that needs to be accounted for. And federal dollars, of course, are a very important part of local district revenue. So we did try to break that out and then kind of focus on, so what is the amount of the state school fund having taken out of the overall expenditure or the overall level of funding in the essential budget level.
Okay. Did you make that follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could you make that recommendation that there should be, as it's done in Ways and Means, that they get the full picture when they're crafting the budget? Because right now it's still the silo approach, so much for higher ed, so much for K-12. And when they are presented with the budget, they have that information at
yes.
the same time.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, yes, we have discussed it, and hopefully this is the opening session of this committee. It is the intention of the chair that our information be made available as broadly as possible to help inform exactly the kind of question that you are looking at. And I think particularly the deeper spending analysis can help inform those deliberations, and we would welcome a chance to participate in that.
Thank you.
And my comment would be to create a an arena of transparency so that we know, like, your goals, like, we want to be accountable, just like you do, so that we can do be very thoughtful and making sure we have good decisions.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, and I know I speak for the Chair of the Commission. We are at your service, and we would welcome any opportunity we can, and we can get other members of the Commission available to you if you would like to speak with them. As a matter of fact, the next thing I was going to talk about briefly is the communication initiative. This was at the insistence of the Chair. Susan, I don't know if you would care to comment on that. That one of the things that we wanted to try to do is provide high quality but easy to understand data. You have in your packet a draft, and I emphasize draft, of a brochure. Again, going back to a recommendation that we got from Senator Morse at the commission, we asked the senator, so what would be helpful to you? And what he said was, well, I never see where we were, where we are now, and what the difference is. Nobody ever explained that to me. And we said, that's a pretty good idea. Let's see if we can put something together that looks at where past spending was, where our current spending was, and compare that to the model, and see if we can do it in a way that is clear and easy to understand. So the draft has not yet had the full approval of the commission. It will go before the commission at its next meeting. But that's given to you as an example of what we're trying to do with the communication initiative. So what did the commission find? Very briefly, we're finding, when we looked at the data, that student progress in reaching benchmarks has slowed in some grades, particularly at the middle and high school level. Per student funding in Oregon has dropped below the national average. Special student populations, particularly special education students and limited English proficient students, are increasing faster than the general student population. This is particularly true with limited English proficient students. And those student populations require greater resources. Class sizes have risen. Course offerings outside of the subject areas tested in the standardized testing system appear to be narrowing. This is a concern to all of us, particularly since the State Board this morning approved increases in the state graduation requirements. So there is a lot to talk about there. No surprise, and I think this gets at some of what Representative Menes was just referring to, the alignment of the pre-kindergarten Oregon Head Start, the K-12 system, the community college system, and the university system is not well done. And that was a finding of the commission and something that I think all of us share. I know the three sectors are committed and the governor is committed to addressing that issue. So the commission recommended providing adequate and stable funding for Oregon schools to continue the achievement gains by targeting research-based activities, such as early childhood development programs, the early reading initiative, and high school restructuring, as three examples where we know additional investment would have payoff on the achievement of standards by Oregon students, and to conduct additional research. We find the idea of doing production function analysis to be particularly relevant to the questions that we're trying to answer. We want to continue to build an integrated data system. We are very grateful to the legislature in the past two sessions that have seen its way through to provide funding for the work that is currently underway. To continue our efforts to look at governance and accountability structures in the state and to develop our capacity to evaluate the impact of education on the Oregon economy. And finally, I don't have a slide, but those two alternatives that we are charged by statute to generate, you will see in the report there are two. One is to take the difference between where we are and what the model would recommend and spread that difference out over a period of time. Our recommendation is 10 years. And break that up into incremental additional investments rather than to try to get to close that spending gap in the near term. The second recommendation or the second alternative way to think about it, is to focus on research-based activities, not do everything, but to pick a set of priorities that we know will work, that have the support of the legislature and the Oregon public, and to put our investment there. So I'm done, Madam Chair. Thank you for your attention. The website that you see on the slide is where you and the public can go to get copies of the report. It is on our website. The research from Echo Northwest is also on our website, as are all the past reports from the commission. All that information is on our website. Thank you.
Thank you. Susan, did you have comments before we take questions?
I'm not sure I have anything to add. I certainly do admire those who are doing the nuts and bolts, nitty-gritty of this work. It takes a lot of thoughtfulness, as you can tell. And so I'm proud to be part of the effort. But I guess if I wanted to reiterate anything, it's just how much we really want to be involved in providing any help that we can on education data.
Okay. Thank you. Knowing that we have another presentation today, I will take questions. If we have to get further research, I'm certainly open up to that. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question about the mechanics of the model. You were at pains to say that these schools are prototypes, not models.
Correct.
But am I correct that they do, the prototypes are developed under the assumption that if we built this prototype school, 90% or more of students would meet standards?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, that's correct. That's why it's important to look at the assumption. So you're assuming a certain class size, a certain level of funding for supplies and materials, a certain level of investment in professional development for teachers. It assumes that those things are in place and we can identify what they cost. So the assumption is that a school that reflected those characteristics would be able to produce a student achievement level at approximately 90%.
Quick follow-up,
yes.
Madam Chair. And is it then possible to look at what happens when aspects, elements of that prototype school are changed one way or another and show the impact, expected impacts on student achievement?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, let me be specific. The model assumes, if you read the assumptions, that the school is located relatively near an urban center with approximately 15% of its student population non-English speaking or in English as second language programs. That's the assumption in the model, just to create the prototype. Now, you could take that assumption and say, no, I want to look at a school where 70% of the students are non-English speaking or limited English speaking. By taking the financial component of the model to provide those programs, but dramatically increasing the population, the model then shifts the amount of investment that would be needed. It's basically a spreadsheet that you can change assumptions in the model, and then you change levels of expenditure. The important element, I believe, is to begin to distinguish that per pupil number based upon, if you will, an average assumption. And when you change the assumptions, then you change the results of the model.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Burr.
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Representative Dolan.
Yes, if I go to the website and look at the best practices you've established, is it footnoted and can I go find the research?
You can, Madam Chair, Representative Dolan, yes, the material is footnoted in the document, and then past research is also in the archives that is available. But the best practices that we're looking at are, I would say, at somewhat of a global rather than an individual classroom level. So, for example, one of the best practices is regular investment in ongoing professional development of faculty. And there's an abundant amount of research that says that's a good thing to do for improving school quality. And there's that type of information on the website.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your work. It's fantastic to get this information. Thank you for the presentation. I'm wondering on the information you provided, the comparison between now and 15 years ago, the increase in special ed students.
Yes.
Can you provide any, even just a brief, I know there's detail in the report, but a brief explanation from what the commission's found in terms of that increase in numbers?
I can, Madam Chair. Representative Buckley, you also will be hearing from Nancy Latini of our staff later today, and she's the real expert in this area. What we have found is as the technology for identifying student need has improved, we've also seen an increase in the number of students identified. That's one element. So, for example, you may be aware that autism has emerged in the last several years as a very significant problem, particularly in young children. Now, I don't think there's been a dramatic increase in the number of kids with autism. What I do think is our ability to identify those kids and to bring their families into connection with the school has improved. In particular, I would say, and I would urge you to talk with Nancy about this, Oregon has developed a national reputation in its use of a model called response to instruction. And what RTI does is that it helps match instructional program to identified student need. And faculty and specialists are trained to analyze that. So if you're watching a student who is not responding appropriately in a level of instruction, long before you ever get to saying the student's special ed or has some other need, to adjust the instructional program and to gather data on a regular basis on how that student is progressing. As we've done that, what we find is we can identify kids sooner and more accurately. The third thing I would say is Oregon has, for many years, had a commitment to high-quality services from birth to five. And what we are able to do in consultation with families and human service providers is identify families where there might be a high-risk pregnancy or some early identification, even as early as birth, that a student needs service. And as we get better at doing that, the total population begins to rise. So I think my personal opinion is that I think we're getting much better at identifying students in need rather than this dramatic increase in the population. The other thing I would say, however, and I've had doctors point this out to us, that as medical science has improved the ability to have high-risk pregnancies result in a successful birth, some of those children are born with need. Now, some of those students, some of those children might not have survived 20 years ago, and they survive now. But when they survive, they may arrive at our doorstep in a high-need category. And we, of course, are committed to serving every child that shows up, and we welcome that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Susan, go ahead. Now I just have one last question.
By your grace, I would like to add one note. You may think that we're completely ignoring the No Child Left Behind legislation because we haven't talked about it.
I thought we were going to get through this without that.
And we can continue and finish without that if you'd like. But I wanted you to know that the commission is not ignoring it. You may know that its standards are even higher than Oregon standards, and as soon as we know exactly what we can do to achieve those standards from some kind of a realistic point of view, it will be much easier to put them in our report. But for now, we're working on it. We're not ignoring it, and we realize that it's there. And so, you know, there are some teeth in that legislation we all need to be aware of.
Thank you. Point well taken. I just had one question for Mr. Burke. If a school district wants to, can a school district call you up and say, you know, plug my figures in this way and to look at program evaluation needs? How would they do that?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. Actually, several districts have done that. Gresham Barlow did that several years ago. Eugene Forjay has done that. The model is easily available, and the elements of the model are fairly straightforward, and many districts have, in fact, reworked their budget along the lines of the model itself. Not surprisingly, they find that, and this is where it's helpful, they might find that their transportation costs are way out of alignment with what the model would recommend, or that their ESL bilingual expenditure is much lower than what the model recommends, reflecting a lack of diversity in that particular district. But they can use the model that way. I would also say, my colleague Brian Reeder, and I believe some of you have seen this, there is a piece of software that we would be happy to share with you that gives you or anyone the ability to take the model and play with it. Plug numbers into it. The software will recalculate the model and let you use it as an analytical tool.
Well, I appreciate your clarification that it's a tool versus a budget demand.
Yes.
And so that it can be it's something that can be utilized. Speaker. Representative Minnis still has a question still.
You can call me anything. Call me Karen. I just wanted to ask you, of course, go right to the number, but you mentioned also it's an accountability tool. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, yes, I can. We're beginning to explore ways that the type of in-depth analysis, particularly a production function analysis, can be used for accountability purposes. Let me give you an example. We've taken information from the database initiative on what districts ESL bilingual enrollment is, how much money that generates in the formula, and then how much they identify as program expenditure as a result of that, and then compare the difference. And not surprisingly, what we find is some districts spend everything they get in the allocation plus. So we have some districts that spend over 100% of their allocation for ESL students specifically on ESL programs. But we also found that some districts were spending less. Now, there are reasons that might occur. ESL bilingual students need to be transported from home to school. There are building maintenance and other types of things that go into that. As you know, the way the weighted funding formula works is that money is in the appropriation, but it's not a programmatic appropriation, it's a general appropriation. So what that has given us, then, Representative Minnis, is a way to have conversations with districts to look at what are you spending versus how well are your ESL bilingual students doing? What is the achievement level? And we've been able then to identify, it was fairly clear, as I mentioned in my remarks, as spending on instruction increases, student achievement increases. So where we see places where achievement is low and spending is low, compared to the formula allocation, we've been able to have accountability discussions with those districts about what they're doing with the money. Now, that's one example. I think we're going to get even better at that as we look at ways of tracking these expenditures more carefully against student achievement. That's relatively new for us. If you remember from the last session, 2 years ago, we were talking with you about the use of something called the Secured Student Identifier, or SSID. This is relatively new technology. So for the first time, we can now specifically monitor every student in the state, regardless of school district. So it becomes more powerful to look at school or school district funding and student performance. And we can do that right down to a school level.
Any other further questions from the committee? Well, I want to personally thank you. Seriously, I've heard about the QEM. I've looked at the proposed what it would take to fund this model at 80%, and that's all I thought it was a budget request. And to find out it has many of the components that, you know, Echo Northwest is recommending, and that it's, you know, I want to continue learning, and if the committee wants additional information, please let me know and what your thoughts are. But I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
at this time because we have a tremendous amount of conversation going on in our legislature about taking care of the needs of all children. There are a number of early childhood programs out there, and including myself, I have a background from 6th grade on to 12th grade, but those early years, there's a lot I have to learn. So with the suggestion of one of my colleagues, Representative Gelser, she said, Betty, are you going to do something on early childhood? And I said, I would love to. And she gave me some great recommendations, and with that, please have Nancy Latina come forward and Judy Newman.
Chair Comp, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, and I'm here today to provide you with some information on early childhood education programs that are directed by the Department of Education. All of these programs are located in my office, and I'm very pleased that you're interested in asking some questions about a very important element of the education enterprise. When Susan Castile came into office, she made it very clear that she wanted all of the activities that focused on early childhood into one unit. At the time, she wanted what she said is a single voice talking for the youngest learners in Oregon. And it was a good decision. Before that time, there were three different offices dealing with early childhood activities. They weren't only in different offices, but they were also in different buildings. And while the staff tried to talk to each other about early childhood issues, they really didn't have an umbrella or a vision about what did we want for all of these children in Oregon in order to get them ready for school. And that's what our superintendent was asking for. Now with a single director and a single unit, it's much easier for us to predict and look at what is it that we need, and most importantly, what is it that the children need in order to be ready for when they enter kindergarten. For example, one of the things we've been able to do is to set up and move forward on a single accountability and outcome system that I'll share a little bit with you a little later. And also, we've been able to have people now talk about the PK-20 or structure, and not just the K-12 or the K-20, but we're getting the PK in there, and it's very important for people to understand that. While it's not part of the state school fund, it definitely is a part of closing the achievement gap and to supporting children as they get ready for school. Today I'm going to share information about four programs that are in the Department of Education, and I'll do sort of a highlight so that you have time for questions, and I certainly want Judy to have time to talk as well. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Oregon Head Start Pre-K program. I'm going to talk about the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education program, the Even Start program, and the Teen Parent program. And then I'll share some overall initiatives that we're working on in order to be able to measure that our children are getting ready for and being supported for school, that we have high-quality experiences for our children, and that we support the transition to kindergarten, which is vitally for many of our families. Each of you has a program description, a one-page description, I think, in front of you as a handout. The efforts in the early childhood programs are really based on the knowledge that children with special needs of any sort who attend preschool can oftentimes overcome personal, familial, and community barriers to the learning process. For most part, the children that are 3 and 4 years old that come to our programs really do demonstrate much lower developmental skills than the children in their same age group. The desired outcome for this program and all of these programs is to assist these children to either catch up with their peers or to help accommodate some types of special needs so at least they're at some sort of a level playing field with the other children when they enter kindergarten. The Head Start Pre-K program in Oregon was enacted by Oregon legislation in 1987 to provide what we called a comprehensive early childhood school readiness program for our poorest and most in need 3 and 4 year olds and their families. The legislature determined that it was that comprehensive program rather than a single isolated preschool program that would reap the most benefits. So in other words, the program would offer these integrated services and referrals similar to what the Head Start program was doing with their families, and all the families are the same. And what we tried to do and what they did in those early days even is a seamless system. The parents didn't need to know where the funding was coming from, whether it was federal Head Start or a state-funded OPK program. What they needed to know is what their children needed to know and to help their children to learn. We can take care of the paperwork at the department. That isn't something that teachers or children and families need to do. So an OPK then is expected to, under Oregon administrative rule, is to operate according to those federal Head Start performance standards. And by aligning our programs together, we really do benefit from many things. We benefit from all the training that Head Start is funding for teachers. We benefit from the monitoring system that Head Start has and that it helps us with funding the monitoring piece. And also it leverages local funding and matches for local programs in some way because we're doing that. The programs are designed to meet the individual needs of children through instructional planning, whether it's language, literacy development, math, any of the other pre-academic skills as well as the social skills. They emphasize also the strengthening of family efforts, and they work to support those efforts through referrals to other agencies if they're needed, and also to help the families become strong advocates for their children as they enter the education system. I know when I was in a district, I could certainly tell some of the parents that came into school that had been in Head Start because they were very much more confident of what they could ask for and how they could interact with schools. And sometimes as the children got older, it waned a little bit, and of course, that was my interest of keeping those families strong and participating in school. The funded programs include, as far as people who provide the programs, include several different types of entities. School districts have Head Start OPK programs. The educational service districts do, nonprofit agencies, community colleges, and universities. The Head Start funding flows directly to the programs. It doesn't come through the Department of Education. There's a small amount of money that comes to the department that helps with the monitoring, the dissemination of information to make sure parents know and agencies know where to go if they need to refer children, and a liaison staff person. The state OPK fund, and that's why I think a lot of people get confused, and I should say this, we talk about Head Start, OPK, Oregon Pre-K, and people will say, what's the difference? Where they really aren't different other than the funding and how we blended them together. The OPK funds then go directly to grants awarded by the Department of Education, and these are considered grant and aid funds. These funds, the OPK funds are included in all the Head Start programs that we have, but we also have eight state-funded programs that do not have Head Start funds in them. They're very small programs. They're meeting the needs of the community. They don't feel that they need the extra federal funds because of the numbers of kids they have, so they get the state funds. They write for a grant and get it, and yet they are still a part of the system, the integrated system. Every county has some kind of a Head Start OPK program. Head Start requires also that their program save 10% of their slots for students with disabilities. The selection process and how families get into the program, first of all, is based on income. And at this point, the example is a family of four cannot make over $20,000 a year to be eligible for the program. And then there's an additional piece to this, and each of the communities can look at other risk factors. Every program has a waiting list, so they determine within their community what those risk factors might be that would move a child in quicker than another child and how children get on wait lists. And those factors really vary. There could be a history of drug abuse, a history of child abuse and neglect, disability of either an adult or of a child, alcohol issues, mental health issues, second language issues. There's a variety of them, and the communities can select those, and they write those into their plan. These programs also then offer the referrals as needed for families. They can include dental referrals, comprehensive health care, parenting education, and other family services. There's also a program that you might hear about that's called Early Head Start, which serves children birth to two. These are not part of this program. They're separate. The funds go directly to agencies. The federal government has not asked the department to oversee these programs. We do have some in Oregon, but those are ones that are not part of the department program. Both of these programs, Early Head Start and Head Start OPK, have a direct relationship to our early childhood special education program, which I'm going to talk a little bit about next. So we're going to move into the early intervention, early childhood special education program. These programs were enacted in 1989, and the Oregon legislature transferred the responsibility for the birth to two special education program to the Department of Education from the Department of Human Services, and that began formally in 1992. This program is funded with state and federal funds and Medicaid reimbursement wherever possible. It's getting more and more difficult to secure Medicaid funds, but we keep working on it. The programs are subjected to all of the requirements of the federal special education laws, and they're monitored by the department at the same time that districts are monitored if they're in whatever district they're located in. Nine ESDs, education service districts, contract to provide these services to our students. Our students and these young children have significantly developmental delays. They have other disabilities also that are well researched into saying these are problems when children get to school, and those would be speech and language disabilities, mental retardation, severe physical disabilities, medical issues, autism, and disabilities as such. The ESDs then subcontract to other agencies to assure that the services are provided in the community sites, and oftentimes providing services in the home for the very youngest children, where they're teaching the families as well as how to deal with the young children with disabilities. The general overall goals of these programs are really to assist the family in understanding what the child's disability is and the potential impact that has on their education. It's also to increase the family capacity to support that child in future as education environments. Of course, it's to improve the developmental and school readiness for the child as we provide the direct services, and also to create the community connections for that family for ongoing child support when the child is in school and in their community. Federally, and the confusing part again on this program, they don't make it easy for us all the time. These are really two separate programs. They have the early intervention program for birth to two children with disabilities, which is funded under one section of the federal law. And the other part of the program is early childhood special education, which is for the 3 to 5 year olds up to kindergarten age, which is funded separately. In Oregon, because we have both programs at the Department of Education, we selected to run a seamless system. Again, it doesn't make any difference to families or staff who's paying for what. We can deal with that at the office, but it should make no difference. And so what we do is call this together, make these programs a seamless system. We're one of very few states that are able to do that or are doing it successfully. The new federal special education law encourages more of this, but when you look at the federal requirements, it is not easy to do. And so I think it's hard to really encourage people to do it. We're lucky we've done it for so many years. We know how to get around some of the questions, and we're very proud that we have that seamless system. The next program I'm going to share with you is the Even Start program, and this is a fairly small program. It's fully federally funded. It's around $2 million for a biennium. And they work with the poor families and their children from birth to age 8. The goal of these programs is, again, to improve parent literacy skills and provide referrals to education opportunities for low-income families, to enhance the parenting skills, and to increase the developmental skills of the child. These grants are awarded at various sites, and the department oversees those to assure that there are delivery of service and there are some outcomes from these programs. They're really family-centered programs to prepare children for school. Statewide, at one time, we had 12 very small sub-grants out there with programs. And currently, with some of the federal cutbacks and a monitoring process, Oregon decided that we were going to fund 6 and fund them at a better quality and higher quality with more money so that they could do more and to demonstrate some outcomes. So that's where we are at this point. Oftentimes, this is a program that catches some of the Head Start kids who could be on a waiting list and at some point then move into the Head Start program. The final program in this department is the Teen Parent Program. And here again is a very small program, and it's operated from the department, but it's federal funds that go to the Employment Department. And the Employment Department then gives us the funds to run the program because they're really school-based centered. And these programs are funded to support young parents trying to complete their high school education and trying to help them develop skills to become self-sufficient, responsible parents. Some of the sites have child care centers right there, and they use these for hands-on experiences to learn child development skills. It is important that these programs, and any program, especially those programs with young children, we haven't really spent a lot of time looking at outcomes and how accountable we can be, because it's always a nice thing to do is to provide services and get young children ready for school. But we're now looking at what are the outcomes and seriously trying to look at some measurements. We've enacted several initiatives that I'm pretty excited about right now that we're moving on. The first one was to create a set of early learning foundations. Content standards are probably what you're used to hearing. In the early childhood world, we're calling them foundations. And what these are they are aligned to our school-age content standards. And what our hope is that as early childhood teachers see what is expected in school, their instruction then would be more targeted to the same type of instruction and outcomes, so our kids really would be more ready to for preparing for school. Following that, we've also developed an observational statewide assessment. It's been developed by a contract between the department and Portland State University, and it's based on these early learning foundations or content standards. The teachers then are able to rate their the child's performance during any of their regular day-to-day routines. You don't sit down and do paper pencil. You don't sit down and ask questions, but you're able to do an observation and rate them on those. Again, hoping that this will show us some of the outcomes that we do expect for kids as far as the important elements in getting ready for school. You heard Pat Burke talk a little bit about this secure student identification number. What's been very exciting for us is we now have all of our early childhood children identified and have SSID numbers, so we'll be able to follow and have longitudinal studies for the first time with this group of children, because as long as they stay in Oregon schools, they'll have the same number and we'll be able to do something with that. Somebody asked us one day not long ago if we could look at the number of children who had preschool who are in like New McLaren and some of the correctional facilities. It would be so easy if we had those numbers, and it would be very difficult without them, and we could not provide that. We'll also be a part of the kids system that you're hearing so much about as far as the data integration system. And so the P in the PK program has gotten to be pretty important to us right now. We've also engaged other agencies to work with us, all the agencies that work with young children, to talk about what our goal is to get kids ready for school, whether it's helping parents. But somehow what we need to do is make sure these children that have any kinds of needs and their families or are in school get ready for kindergarten. And so what we've done is we've gotten together and had this commitment, and a document has been developed that's called Transition to Kindergarten. And what this document is, and it's developed by all of these agencies, is a way for schools to look at all of the elements that are important to welcome new kindergarten and their families into school, whether it's community agencies within their community, whether it's the child care centers that they should be involved with, and giving them some suggestions and checklists and brochures around how to engage all of those people. So that will that document is going to be coming out at the end of March, and it'll also be on our website. And then the other activity that has gone on for the last three sessions that we look at carefully is the Kindergarten Readiness Survey. Many of you know that the best way to gauge what happens in preschool is to ask kindergarten teachers. And so there is a survey that the kindergarten teachers are asked to rate their classes on their children in their classes on the importance and their level of preparedness on six elements. In November, the teachers have a chance to get to know their kids. That's when the survey opens and they can rate their children. We're right now in the process of analyzing that data. You'll have a copy of that in March as well. So I covered my material rather quickly. I want you to have time for questions, and I'm hoping I didn't confuse you all. This is an area that's been very exciting for me to watch in Oregon at this time, but I also want you to have a chance to hear some from the real world and listen to Judy and some of her information. So I thank you for your time, and I'm willing to ask if there are any questions that you might have.
Thank you. You did cover a lot of information. I think we just have a couple questions. Representative Buckley?
You've covered the information very well. Thank you so much. A question on the early intervention and early childhood special education programs. Can you please tell me what the eligibility requirements for those programs are?
Are you going to talk about that?
Can you talk about that? No, yes. I'll withdraw my question, Madam Chair. And
if I don't do a good job, you can...
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back to you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Looking at the teen parents, we have a program in Deschutes County for the students that are pregnant or parenting to finish their degree. The 506 students graduated. what percentage? Because that's not the two, the 2114, I'm sure, not just seniors. So is it, what's our success rate in getting them a degree, GED, or through the school system?
Chair Comp, Representative Wisnett, that was a good question. And actually, when I was reading this last night with the weather, we were doing all of this by electronic means. Nobody could get together. The note said rate of graduation and had the 500 figure, and I thought, well, that isn't a rate, and so I will get that information back to you.
I hope it. Do you think it's, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up, please.
Do you think that we're doing good in that? Do you know offhand? Or do you want to look at
what I believe from the program is that we're engaging those students actively in school, and they have a reason for coming, and the reason for not coming can't be that we don't have child care for them. Many of these kids are in families that the families won't have support for taking care of the child so they can come to school. And probably more important is if they're engaging and learning how to become more self-sufficient and good parents at the same time.
Thank you.
The follow-up to that is I think people would be surprised if you had a, just say what the age range is in the students in that program, because I've dealt with students as young as seventh grade.
Yes,
there's a
question.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. On programs like your Head Start Pre-K, do you do any look-back studies to see where these kids are who have been in the program X number of years out? Have they, you know, dropout rate, success rate, how will you measure success?
Chair, Comp, members of the committee, that's a very good question. There are a lot of studies, not in Oregon particularly, but there have been a lot of studies on what happens to children. I think there's some very famous ones that I could get you copies of that you've probably heard about in the past, the Perry School preschool study that followed children through, actually through adulthood, and they have found, not by particular persons, but that more of them have higher paying jobs, less of them have been incarcerated, more of them have family engaged with their families, have higher income rates. There are several studies like that are out there. What we're looking at right now, or we're trying to find more solid studies, there are some small studies, but what happens academically through the years with the children. We've found studies that take kids up to almost middle school. We're trying to look at how tight those research base is so that we could start using those as well.
Representative Cannon, and then we're going to move on to the rest of the presentation, see if our questions are answered. But
thank you. Can you remind us of the percentage of children who are eligible for Head Start Oregon Pre-K who are not currently served under the program?
Chair Comp, Representative Cannon, we right now serve approximately 60% of the students that are eligible and their families for the program, Head Start pre-kindergarten program. Unlike the special education program, we cannot have a waiting list. If you find a child eligible, you have got to provide services immediately. But right now, we are at 60% of the eligible families.
Thank you. Any other questions, or are we ready to hear from Judy? Okay, Judy, if you'd state your name for the record and share us your information.
Chairwoman Comp, members of the committee. I read my notes. I don't do this that often. My name is Judy Newman, and I am one of the directors of a local early intervention, early childhood special education program. I've also been the past chair of the state interagency coordinating council, so I've had some interactions at the state level, and that's where I met Representative Gelser. We were on the committee together, and we were around about the time the early intervention, early childhood special education services became law in Oregon. So it's very exciting. And I've been working in early childhood. It's really an honor for me to be able to come and talk to you. It's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I've been in this field for about 30 years. So I'm not an expert in technology, so I'm going to try to get this going. It's my third time, but I am somewhat of an expert in early intervention. So I'm using my third try here on a IBM, but hopefully this will open it.
The shortcut, yeah.
He said just click twice.
Try it again.
Do you know which?
On the blue part.
On the blue part. Okay, see?
Open.
Thank you.
Hey.
There you go. Okay, now I just have to find the slides down here.
Red one on the side.
On the side.
No, keep going on the left.
It looks very different on a Mac. So do you know how to open a slideshow? To here?
Up above. Keep going over. There you go.
Okay. Hopefully it'll run itself.
What a team. What a team.
What's
that?
Yeah,
this one?
No, that one should work. You just have to click it.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Now let's hope it runs itself.
Looks like it is, yeah.
Good.
The name of the program that I am one of the directors for is EC Cares, and that is the it's in service area 7 in Lane County. And that's what makes it. Okay. EC Cares is the early intervention and early childhood special education program in service area 7. It's special education for children from birth to kindergarten. That's really important. It was mandated in federal law, federal IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, in 86, and became law in Oregon in 1992. And what I want you all to know, because I know you're from all over Oregon, is there's a program like ours in every one of your communities. So Nancy mentioned we're divided into 9 regions, but every single county has a program. And I just wanted to give you an idea of if you can maybe find which service area your constituents are in. And the number at the top, 493 eligible children, for example, is how many children are in service area 1. And we can break that down by county. I just didn't have time before the testimony. So you can see service area 3, 4, 5, and all the counties, associated counties. And again, these are March 1st, 2006 numbers. So who are we? Early intervention provides services to children birth to 2 with developmental delays or kids who are at risk of having delays. Early childhood special education provides services to children 3 to 5 years of age with developmental delays, disabilities, and sensory impairments. Hopefully, the early intervention services we provide are designed mostly for the youngest kids. We really focus on parents. We focus on those caregivers that are with the children most of the time, and we feel like that is going to get us the most return for our time. And we coach them. We provide information, specific techniques on how to actually teach their child with a special need. For early childhood special education services, we move a little bit more into an educational preschool setting. However, we'd never lose our focus on parents because, as you know, birth to 3, parents are still going to be the folks that are with those kids most. And you're going to hear later some comments from parents, and you're going to know that that is what is so important to them because they're with those kids 24/7. And there's no, kids don't come with directions. Kids with special needs definitely don't come with directions. So. Eligibility criteria, I hope this answers your question. All children that come into the program get assessed with a standardized assessment and also curriculum-based assessment, which is more functional. But there are really clear standards for making kids eligible. Kids in early intervention, birth to 2, have to have 1 area of very significant delay or 2 areas of moderate to significant delay. Now, we are able to make some kids eligible based on a physician statement. So the classic example is you might have a child born with Down syndrome. You know, day 1, those kids are not delayed. But we know they're going to become delayed and need special services. So we want to start right away. Same thing with some hearing and vision impairments. And same thing, we're finding kids that are born below 1,200 grams, really premature, are almost always guaranteed to have problems. So we want to get in there day 1. And we work with our NICUs and our hospitals to make sure that happens. For early childhood special education, this was backwards, that's interesting. Those are the 3 to 5-year-olds. Again, we do standardized testing and criteria-based testing, and those children have to have 2 areas of delay at 1.5 standard deviations each, which is a moderate to significant delay. They also can have an eligibility, just like school age, that's a category, vision, hearing, orthopedic impairment, autism, communication, brain injury, traumatic brain injury, other health impaired. You can see them listed. And Nancy already talked to you about the seamless system. We're really proud of that because we had to work very hard to make this happen. But it really minimizes unnecessary transitions for children and families. It's not, you know, as the kids get older, you identify them. So a lot of the children in early intervention are identified at age 2. And then suddenly you don't want to be switching agencies and programs. You really want to make sense for kids. How do we serve children? Well, each children, based on these assessments that we do, they get identified their needs, and a plan is written for them. And then based on that plan, we choose from different ways of providing services. So kids can get services in their home with parent training. They can attend parent-toddler classes, skill groups. If you only maybe have a speech delay or a motor delay, you can come and really focus on that. And we serve kids in specialized preschools and community preschools and provide that community consultation. There's also specialized equipment and adaptations that need to be made for these kids in community preschools and at home. And that's what our program does. Now, the people who work in early intervention, early childhood special education are highly qualified. They are licensed teachers, and they have a specialty with young kids. So we have early childhood special educators and early interventionists. And those are really special education teachers. They have licenses from teacher standards and practices, and they have the same qualifications, master's degrees. Very skilled, but they specialize with this age group. Speech and language pathologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, autism specialists, behavior specialists, deaf and hard of hearing, vision specialists, interpreters, and evaluators. We have the full complement of professionals that serve these young kids because they have kids with disabilities. So, how do kids get into services? Well, who can make a referral? Anyone. That's the very nice thing about this program. You just need to call, and this is our number because this is our local program. But every single one of the programs, I gave you a brochure. I think it's sort of a goldenrod color, and it has a contact number for every county. There's a central point of referral, and families find us. So once a referral is made, we do a developmental screening to see if, in fact, there is a problem, a delay. And if there is, one of those very in-depth evaluations that I spoke about with standardized and criterion reference tests are given. Eligibility is determined or not determined if they don't meet the criteria. And then a plan is developed. And the plan identifies, again, the child's needs, the goals, and the services that we will do to meet that child's needs. And then a placement is made. And those placements really talk about where we're going to do this. Are we going to do this in the home? Are we going to do this in preschool, in child care? And that's determined with the family, because families have some choice in this. Who refers children to EC Cares? This is true of my partners around the state. Well, basically anyone who suspects a child of having a disability. And we track our referral sources, and I just listed the top few referral sources for us. The vast majority of our referrals come from parents. Parents usually know when there's some kind of a problem with their child. The next biggest referring source for us are child care providers, Head Start programs. Physicians are a huge referrer, and then DHS child welfare as well. We wanted to note that, you know, I hear this from families all the time. If they wanted to go out and purchase these services, if they had all the money in the world, a lot of these private therapies are not available, certainly not everywhere in the state, and with the specialty of working with young kids. So these are lifeline, these services for families. And once again, cuts in other services in early childhood arena really result in some more pressures put on our program. These are our numbers and how we have grown. This is our local chart of growth. And the program was new in 92, and it's taken a while to get the word out. So it's really taken a while to reach all our physicians and all our child care providers. But you can see we are growing at a fairly rapid rate. We feel like we're finding the right kids. At some point, we should probably level out. But we also know the numbers of kids eligible in school in special ed is growing. It probably is no surprise that they'd be growing with young kids, too. And just to let you know, we are not unique in Region 7. This is a graph for the state that shows a very similar growth. So this is happening all over. I want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing, current trends. As I said, I've been doing this for 30 years, and these trends are really real. Isn't she cool? I didn't have anything to do with her, but we know that more and more of our children are living in poverty, and I know you've seen those statistics, you know, statewide. We know this. We have to check eligibility for Medicaid for all of our children because Nancy mentioned we do bill for Medicaid services whenever we can. 50% of the children in EC Care services are eligible for Medicaid. That's living in pretty impoverished situations. Abuse and neglect. We have 13% of our kids are in foster care. So we know those kids that are placed in foster care have experienced some kind of trauma, whether it's neglect or abuse. 13%. It's been rising. A couple years ago it was 11, but this year I just checked our numbers and it was 13. We've had an increase in autism as well. 8 to 10% of our kids each year are eligible with autism and identified. And some of that has to do with the tools that we have. We're able to identify kids more earlier, which is fabulous because the research on autism really indicates the earlier you get kids, the better. But 8 to 10% of our kids. We've had an increase in multiple disabilities, and I think there was a conversation about a lot of these children are surviving that might not have survived, and we're seeing them in our services. And then last but not least, there has been a real increase in behavior and social-emotional needs. And this is really aggressive behavior that we're seeing in more and more children. I just was on the phone this morning with a parent who called me. We were talking about something else. Her child was kicked out, as she said, of three different preschool programs before they found a program, before they found our services and a program that would keep him with supports. And this is not a unique story. And so we're finding this more and more, which is putting some more pressures on our programs. How are we funded? Again, Nancy talked about this. We get federal funds, and these are just approximate because they shift a little bit, but about 20% is IDEA. State general funds are about 78 or more percent of our programs, and that's what you all are going to be looking at. We're in the grant and aid budget along with the Oregon pre-kindergarten program. We bill Medicaid fee for service, and the last couple years, we were a little bit under 2%, and we're seeing that decrease, not because we're getting a decreased number of kids eligible. As you saw, half our kids are eligible for Medicaid. But the reimbursement rates are going down, and what we can actually bill for is really getting less and less. So we're seeing that diminish. Okay, why start early? Well, many of you probably know these, but let me give you three really good reasons. First of all, we know that in brain development, 90% of a kid's brain develops in the first 3 years of life. The other fact that we need to know from several longitudinal studies that we can reduce academic failure, we can reduce school dropout rates, incarceration rates, and increase future earnings. And financial investment. We've had the privilege of having a couple, one researcher and one economist in our state from the Minnesota Federal Reserve Bank, and they have actually done an analysis of all the early childhood data that's out there. And they have said that for every dollar invested, there's a $4 to $17 return. And they have concluded that an investment in early childhood is the absolute best investment anyone can make. I think that's pretty cool coming from these Federal Reserve guys. So. And this is a graph that I think sort of sums it all up. If you look at the top line, it really shows brain growth. And you can see that dramatic growth in the first 3 years. Wow. And the bottom line is our public expenditure of dollars. And you can see there's sort of a disconnect between these two. So my vision, my hope for the future is that we make those a little more in line with each other in Oregon and in our nation. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about outcomes because we do track outcomes in our program. These are my local outcomes, but I know, again, our partners around the state are finding some similar things. First of all, 100% of the kids that come to our program get screened for vision, hearing, and medical issues. And we all know how important it is to catch those things early. And it's hard to catch them sometimes in little kids early unless you really look. 100% of the children in our programs get looked at individually. They get a plan. They get goals. They get a really clear idea of what works and how to really improve their outcomes. 95% of the children in our program made measurable gains. You might ask, why didn't 5%? Well, we do have some kids that have serious medical issues or degenerative problems, and so holding their own is the best we can do. But we monitor our kids at least once a year, and many of them twice a year, with evidence-based, curriculum-based assessments. And so that's where we see the gains. And I'm not going to go over this. You can read this. These are the areas we measure, what it means when we talk about measuring kids in developmental areas. But here's just some examples of what we see. The first two bars show cognitive development in Zachary in 1 year's time. And you can see he increased in skills. Same thing with communication in each one of the developmental areas. When you have time, you can study these. I'm sure you would like to. And Kara is another child, again, who pre and post in a year's time made these kinds of gains in the areas of her delays. And the last example is Joshua, who only had a communication problem in expressive and receptive language, but made very good gains. And again, these are about one-year intervals. We also survey our families every year. So every year we send out 1,200 surveys. These were our results from last year. And 99% of the families were satisfied or very satisfied with the quality of services. 97% were satisfied or very satisfied with the progress their child made. And 97% were satisfied or very satisfied with their child's educational needs were met. We're really proud of these results. And we have a local advisory group, and we have a parent on that advisory group who happens to be a statistician. So he has looked at these. We've been doing these for about 10 years. And he was very helpful for us to see, because we try to keep the questions the same each year to see how we're doing. And he said, in fact, our results were reliable and that we really can share them. So we also get pages and pages of comments, which I think really are the meat of it all and what's really most interesting to me. And I summarize them into three major themes with some examples. But first of all, parents that said that these services really help their kids learn and progress. And they said, results, results, results. My child has made huge improvements this last year. They also said the support that it gives to their family is just invaluable. And you can read this quote from a parent. When you first find out your child is not developing typically, it entirely shakes up your world. EC Care specialists help me and my family deal with the emotional aspects of having a child with disabilities and provides essential services to help our daughter develop to her full potential. We are so grateful that EC Cares was available to help us through this difficult time. And the last theme is that parents really appreciate that they're being taught to teach their own child. They're given skills, they're given tools. We enjoy getting notes from each visit. It reminds us of what we can work on, and the parenting classes have been amazing. And I know Representative Roblin has been there. I wish I could bring all the parents. We do every other year. We meet with our local legislators, and he's been there. And I'm always just so re-energized. You know, we don't give these parents scripts, and they're new. These parents leave our services quickly because kids grow up and enter school pretty fast. But we hear the same things every year. Pretty touching. We also do trainings. We serve kids in 60 different community preschools, and we provide support to those community preschools to increase their quality, help them be able to maintain those kids. I mentioned those kids with behavior problems, and they're really happy with the individualized support they get and the trainings we provide. But here's the last outcome that I really want to share. In Lane County, in Region 7, we've been tracking for the last 5 years what happens to our kids when they go to school, because we can do that. We're a little bit smaller than the whole state. But with our SSID numbers, we're going to be able to do that statewide.
Yep.
But 14 to 21% of the kids we serve when they enter school don't need anything. I think that's pretty powerful, and that's held pretty constant, very constant over the last 5 years. That's been the range. Of those kids that do enter school needing some services, we feel they enter the most ready to learn of any kids that come through the door, because they enter already with goals identified, with an eligibility, with some examples of techniques that work with them, how we can best teach this child, what kinds of adaptive materials are needed. So they really show up ready from day one. 25% of the kids that do enter with an eligibility need fewer services than they needed when they were with us. And 47 to 56% of the kids start right off in regular kindergarten with some support. So we're pretty proud of how our kids are entering school. Community collaborators. Just so you know that there are a lot of early childhood programs out there, and early intervention, early childhood special ed works very closely with them. Head Start is a huge partner, Relief Nursery, Public Health. You can see the list of the programs. You've probably heard about these programs. They are great referrers. They refer kids to our services, and we also refer to them. Some of our kids have a lot of basic needs that they need met and other needs, so we work collaboratively. So I just want to take one short minute to talk about a program that Nancy talked about that we get a lot of questions, and that's Oregon Pre-Kindergarten, how we work together. Ooh, where'd that go? My circle bounced off the screen. Isn't that amazing? There was a circle there. You have it on your But EC Cares is the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed Program. So we have 1183 kids in March. There's the other circle. Well, they were over. And then Head Start in Lane County has 788 kids. And then if you can imagine, and you can see this on your own PowerPoint, those are overlapping a little bit. So we share, as of March last year, 189 children. So you might say, well, shared means they're eligible for Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start and for Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed. So for these kids, let me just give you an idea of how that works together, because people always ask, are you duplicating? Why do we have both programs? But we really need both programs to meet these kids' needs. Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed provides a specialized instruction, which means they go into the classroom, they help those kids function in these regular education classrooms, they modify curriculum, they work with the teachers and teaching assistants. They provide the additional therapies that are needed for the child to function within the classroom and any adaptive equipment and materials. The Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start provides the excellent classroom, medical and dental services, nutrition services, mental health services. So what we do together then, we work together to really maximize the resources. We collaboratively can make comprehensive educational planning, progress monitoring, transition to kindergarten, family education and support, links to community resources and services. Thank you very much for your time. I hope that this was helpful. And if you have any questions, I have how you can contact me.
Thanks, Judy. I do have, I think, a couple questions.
Good.
And I'm going to, hopefully they'll be very brief. We need to conclude here within a few minutes. But Representative Roblin?
I just wanted to say, for those of you that have not visited the programs in your area, I have had the distinct opportunity to visit with Judy and to visit with the parents and there. And a great program in Florence. And the school district has cooperated with Head Start as a great new facility located on the campus. And watching the people work together is an impressive thing. And I guess the thing from a public school, the you know, high school, one of the things I think these early education programs do better than we have done and will help education all the way through is they are very honest and direct with the parents. And they develop plans based around the real needs of those kids. And sometimes we get parents and kids who come to school and no one is honest and really talks about what we have to do to get you where you need to be. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult conversation to have if you haven't had it before. These conversations happen with these kids and these families from day one in these early intervention programs. And those parents come prepared to talk realistically with the teachers when they get to the school. And it makes the whole thing work really well. I have been really impressed in the last few years that I had a chance. And you can tell Judy's enthusiasm, which is also exceptionally important for any of these programs.
I think it's energizing her so long as we keep her around for another 30
right,
years.
Exactly.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Manager. Yeah, Judy, I was actually going to encourage you to get some passion about your work. I'm going to just combine this real quickly because I did talk about eligibility before. From your presentation, it appears that there is no financial eligibility restriction, so it opened for all families. So in that case, how are you dealing with the fact, are you at capacity, or what happens if you get past what you feel to be capacity?
Well, I can comment and then Nancy can probably add. We don't have a wait list. We can't have a wait
right.
list because these are entitlement services. So we have very passionate, committed professionals, and they just continue to stretch. So class sizes go up, caseloads go up, and they work very, very hard to continue to meet the needs. And, you know, parents are our best partners in this.
The legislature has been very wise in every session holding back some of the money they allocate to the program. And as we watch the caseload growth, then we go back to the emergency board. And there was a year where we really couldn't demonstrate the growth and we didn't ask for the money. We were very honest about it. However, after that, our numbers again started to skyrocket. In last session, I not only went back to the e-board to ask for the money, but I had to go back again and ask for some more because the numbers are going up. The chart that Judy showed is really correct, and I do think that they're providing the good services. So what we did do before in the last e-board session is we did commit to looking at all of their efficiencies, and it was amazing what these nine programs and superintendents helped us with in telling us what efficiencies. They are very creative in trying to stretch their dollars, and as Judy said, having committed people. We now, though, are going one step further, and we've enlisted a finance expert to come in and look at efficiencies in our program, just to say, is there anything else we can do? I'll be interested in seeing what they can say, but I think it's also another way of at least showing to all of you that we are trying the best way to maximize our dollars.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Yes. Representative Dahl?
That I went in visiting the programs in the Dells, specifically in Madras generally, I think I'm struck principally by how two separate agencies work together, and there is no, we always use the term silo, and there is none.
Yeah.
The child is staffed, needs are met, the plan is drafted, and off they go. And also, I do have some concern that we look at. In the interim, we recommend full funding for Head Start. And I will stay in that position forever. But when we do that, we have a little bit different situation because we have pre-K, K-20, and then higher education, or pardon me, pre-K, K-16, and then 17 to 20. We have budgets that are built entirely differently. And I think that's somewhat to the detriment of our pre-K program because it is not equalized. And I think perhaps that's something that we should look at. It is important to me that an accident of birth ought not to give you more money as one of Oregon's children in one region of the state than it does in another. So I'd really like to look at that equalization piece.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Winston?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, how early can you diagnose autism, and how long is treatment? Is it forever?
Representative Wisnett, I think the youngest that we pretty much diagnose kids would be about 18 months. But that's not that typical. I would say average at 3, 4, 5. But there are definitely screenings, and we're getting better at it. And are we working with kids forever? The field says that kids don't recover from autism, so there are probably some needs that might go on forever. Some individuals really learn how to manage those themselves extremely well, and there's some very strong spokespeople, Temple Grandin being one out there that many of you have probably heard. She's a very articulate engineer. So I think our hope is that people can learn, some of those kids with no cognitive delays, to manage that all themselves.
Well, I really want to thank the panel and the committee today. We've heard two kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, but we're still looking at the data that's coming up, and we do have some parallels in there. And so I hope we all benefited from that. I did. And with that, I will close our meeting today.
Thank you, Nancy.